call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order, and we have a quorum. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 2:50 p.m. on Friday, March 30th, 2018. Present today, we have Representative Ortiz, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Wilson, Co-Chair Seaton, Representative Tilton, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. And Representative Thompson was previously excused from today's meeting. Before we start, just a reminder, folks could please mute their cell phones. And today we'll have three bills before us, HB 212, which is REAA and Small Municipal School District Fund, HB 231, which is the CFEC Board Salary Staff Classified Service, and then HB 316, which is Restricting Access to Marijuana Crime Records. So the first bill up today is HB 212, and I'd also like to recognize that Representative Kutcher, Vice Chair Guerra, is here. So the first bill up is 212, and that is by myself, Representative Foster. Committee has a CS before them, and so at this time, I would like to gavel out and pass the gavel on to Co-Chair Seaton.
Representative Pruitt joined us, and so has Representative Guttenberg. Co-Chair Foster, we'll take a brief at ease while we get set up. Back in order, welcome Representative Foster to the table.
Thank you, Co-Chair Seaton. My name is Representative Neil Foster, Representative District 39. And so HB 212, it expands the regional education attendance area and small municipal school district fund to include major maintenance in addition to new school construction. This will reduce deterioration in schools and, in the long run, save the state money by not having to replace schools at the rate that we have been. And this bill is supported by the Coalition for Education Equity, which is made up of several rural school districts, and the coalition was heavily involved with the Kasaili case. And so if I could, I'd like to turn the presentation over to my staff.
For the record, my name's Jane Pearson, staff to Representative Neil Foster, and I'd like to run you through the explanation of changes on the CS. Section 1 from version D was eliminated in version U. The new CS supports keeping the two lists for school construction and major maintenance as they are currently in statute and not combining them together for REAA. Section 2 is new, amending AS 1411-030B. It adds clarifying language that the unexpected and unobligated balance of the fund may not exceed $70 million. You guys have a legal opinion in your file, and you can see that this is the way this has been done all along. This will add clarity, and it was by request of the department. Section 3 adds a new subsection to AS 1411-030E. It states that not more than 20%, so up to 20% of the fund available for appropriation from the REAA and Small Municipal School District Fund may be used for major maintenance projects. You have a spreadsheet in your package that looks like this. It addresses 20%, and it does it two ways. It does it with the school debt reimbursement program being reinstated on the first page. And on the second page, it deals with without the school debt reimbursement program being reinstated. So you can see that the numbers are slightly different in those two charts. The school construction and major maintenance grant programs are really the only significant programs that provide new construction, renovations, or major maintenance to schools and communities without bonding capacity. A healthy and continued grant program for construction and major maintenance provides a vetted solution to the funding of high-priority major maintenance needs, such as boilers, roofs, and other important systems and safety measures in schools. By way of brief history, in 2010, the legislature passed SB 237, which, among other things, established the REAA attendance areas. And in 2013, five small municipal districts were included in the fund. You do have a list of these school districts in your package. The program has been a major success. The REAA and Small School District Fund is available for funding projects on school construction grant lists and have greatly reduced the number of schools on the construction list. The funding is based on the amount of debt outstanding for municipal schools, adjusted by the amount of money spent on REAA schools, and by the percent of students who attend those schools. The methodology provides a reasonable, consistent level of funding to be used for REAA and small municipal school districts, school construction, and moves the state along the road to addressing concerns that were raised in the Casile case. Since 2014, when the legislature passed SB 64, which placed a moratorium on approving projects that were funded by debt reimbursement, authorized by local voters until July 1, 2020, there has been an increase in applications vying for legislative funding on major maintenance grant funding lists. Therefore, HB 212 and expanding the REAA fund for major maintenance is good for rural Alaska as well as urban Alaska. By adding major maintenance to the REAA and small district fund, other non-REAA projects can rise more quickly to the top of the major maintenance list. And that's the differences in the bill.
Any other questions about the, yes, we haven't had moved before us yet. So let's get a motion. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move committee substitute for House Bill 212, version 30-LS0741/U to be adopted by the House Finance Committee as our working draft.
Is there any objection to that? Seeing none, we have the working draft before us. Representative Foster, and then question.
Thank you, Co-Chair Seaton. I just wanted to summarize. I think that was a lot of information, and I just want to let folks know that this bill does not make the pie bigger. We're not asking for more money. What it is doing is changing how the pie is cut and how it's allocated. And so right now, the fund can only be used for new school construction for REAA schools. We're asking that it be allowed to also be used for major maintenance. And so in a nutshell, that's really what we're looking at. And I just wanted to make sure that folks knew that we're not asking for more money. So thank you.
Thank you. Could you give us the definition of major maintenance?
Major maintenance definition can be found in 1411. 013, and it is projects that avert imminent danger to or correct life-threatening situations. It houses students who would otherwise be unhoused. For purposes of this subparagraph, students are considered unhoused if the students attend school in temporary facilities, protect the structures of existing school facilities, correct building code deficiencies that require major repair or rehabilitation in order for the facility to continue to be used for educational programs, achieve an operating cost savings, modify or rehabilitate facilities for the purpose of improving the instructional program, G, meet an educational need not specified in A through F of this paragraph, identified by the department, and these projects have to be above $25,000.
And a follow-up? And so when you speak of that the major maintenance can be utilized that now, is that major maintenance of any district or only REAA for the major maintenance out of this particular fund?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, those would be the REAA and small municipal district.
And follow up?
Follow up, Representative Wilson.
And what Representative Foster said, as far as allowing those that aren't REAA schools, we have another project list for major maintenance. And so that's what we would see a lot of our urban schools on, which would, because some of the REAA schools could move over underneath this funding, might bring up funding in a different source for the other school districts.
Representative Wilson, through the chair. It is one major maintenance list. It can be found. It's attachment number 4 in your file. Listed State of Alaska Department of Education and Early Development Capital Improvement Projects Major Maintenance Grant Fund.
So follow-up?
Follow-up.
I'm just trying to connect the dots. It was my understanding, so if you're on the project list you're talking about, that if one of the, let's say the top school, it just happens to be an REAA school, they could actually use funding out of this amount versus just a UGF appropriation, which is what we were utilizing only to fulfill this list.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, that is correct.
Thank you.
Representative Tilton Engar.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there any prioritization on maintenance versus new school build, and if so, why or why?
Representative
not?
Tilton, thank you for asking that question through the chair. The reason we went to the 20%, the original bill said it can be used for major maintenance. We wanted to make sure that the first priority was the new schools, and that, you know, 20%, which pretty well averages out on that chart, up to 20%, because there may be times you cannot take 20% because you have a major new construction project. So that is why there is up to 20%.
And a second question, do you know the average lifespan of a school building that is covered by the bill?
Representative Tilton, through the chair, I do not, but we do have somebody from the department here, Tim Merrick, who can speak to that. I think that's his.
Okay, let's go ahead and get the other questions on there, and then we'll come back. Representative.
Thanks, Chair. Thanks, Jane, Representative Foster, for bringing the bill before us. I just have a couple questions. Really not any objection to the bill. I just want to I want to be able to understand, make sure I understand it. It's, and maybe my recollection is wrong. My recollection was that sometimes it was easier to move up the major maintenance list if you had sort of more resources to explain your major maintenance application, and that left districts that did not have as much money at a disadvantage on the major maintenance list. Is that, am I getting that confused with something else, or was that a concern?
Representative Garrett, through the chair, it is a grant program. As with any grant program, applications are required. You can see that under 1411.011 are the requirements for the applications. So if somebody can fill out an application better, there may be a chance they rise on the list. However, if you look at the current major maintenance list, the first school on there, the fifth school on there, the seventh school on there, the eighth school on there, the 14th school on there, the 16th and the 17th school on there are all REAA or small munis.
Thanks. And through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. And I just want, my intention would not be that if we ran out of REAA funds that an REAA school would not be eligible on the major maintenance list if they needed to be, and that's your intention as well. Is that correct? It's just to find an easier source of funding for at least some major maintenance, but it's not to say that if we don't have enough money, they can't be on the major maintenance list, correct?
Representative Garrett, through the chair, that is correct, and that was one of the reasons we did not want it moved into a separate list. We wanted it to stay the same. There is a cap on the REAA Small Municipal School Fund of $70 million. So there have been, in 2011, we rolled money back out of that fund without using it. And so there are times that it would be advantageous to use that for maintenance.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. And seeing no other questions, Representative Tilton had a question, and whichever person from school finance or division director, administrative service, who had be appropriate for her question. And Representative Tilton, could you restate your question? We'll bring them to the table, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So just repeating the question was, did we have the average current lifespan of the schools? This would just help us kind of understand where the maintenance level is.
And yes.
Go ahead and put your
my life on the building.
Yes, thank you. This is Tim Merrig, Facilities Manager at the Department of Education, and Representative Tilton through the chair. There is no published lifespan for schools, but a common one that we use is 50 years as an average.
Did you have any follow-up, Representative
Tilton? Sure, follow-up. So the 50 years would be the average of all schools all over the place or in this REAA area?
Yes, Representative Tilton, through the chair. That average, I'm speaking of various systems in buildings wear out at different lifespans. So whereas you might have a foundation at 50 to 70 years, your roof might have only 25 years. So it's hard to speak of what the average lifespan of a building is because each system has its own particular lifespan. But, you know, on the whole, it's convenient to speak of them. We like to achieve 50 years. Life for our school facilities.
Thank you.
And Mr. Merrick, just for my information, were you talking about the average life of or the average age of the buildings in the REAA, or are you talking about just what is the construction average lifespan of buildings, whether they're in REAA or not, that's their average lifespan, but were you talking about the average age of buildings in the REA system is already used up 50 years?
Sure. Chair Seaton, speaking about the average lifespan of a building, the age, we have some information on that. I don't have it with me about the average age of our schools, but no, I wasn't speaking about the age that we are currently have currently achieved on the average.
Okay, I just wanted to clarify because I wasn't quite sure which the question was.
Thank you.
I want to make sure that if Representative Tilton wanted that information, you could probably provide it to the committee later. Were you? No. Okay. Does anyone else have any questions? Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just looking at the major maintenance list, I have represented the number one and number two on that list at one point and know those schools. My question is, some years when we would fund down one, two, and three, and number four would expect to be at the top of the list in the past, and all of a sudden it would be four or still be three. How does the list get upgraded? Is if somebody comes in with a higher need than the previous number four? I mean, I would assume that if you were number four and they funded the three, you would just assume you would go up the top and not redo your, where you probably, knowing the history, should. But I know that's been a question in the past. It's like, hey, I thought I was next. And all of a sudden, you might even be at a lower place. So can you talk a little bit about how that ranking happens?
And for Mr. Merrick?
Yeah. Sure. Representative Guttenberg. Yes, actually, all the projects are ranked through a series of criteria by points, and so then the points drive priority. If a project was introduced for the first time in a particular fiscal year cycle and its points exceeded other projects that had previously been on the list, then it would rise above them on the priority based on the number of points that it is assigned in the criteria that is developed under the statute.
If I may, Mr.
Representative Guttenberg.
And it changes from year to year, and if a school that's at the top of the list doesn't come back in or comes in with the same point score, does it get a chance to redo its grant application to show 1 year more of need, or does it just are they allowed to do that?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, we every year a district has the opportunity to submit an application. Several years ago, we implemented some regulation when project movement on the capital list was fairly static to allow districts to extend their previous year's application for an additional year so that they wouldn't have to, you know, fully invest in developing a brand new application. And those scores are then carried over for one additional year and would apply to that particular project. Obviously, you know, they would have the opportunity, should they have, would have chosen to do a new application with better or different information that might affect, you know, their scores and drive it up or down.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Are there further questions? Seeing none, thank you
all right.
very much. Let's see. Let's, Representative Foster, do you have anything else to add, or should we go to public testimony?
I think public testimony would be fine.
Okay, thank you. Let's open public testimony. And we have Carrie Boyd from Eagle River. Are you online?
Yep. Yes, I am.
Oh, we can hear you now. Would you go ahead and identify yourself and who you represent for the record, and then go ahead with your testimony?
Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Carrie Boyd. I am the superintendent of UConn Koyukuk School District in our EAA district. And thank you. I'm testifying in support of House Bill 212. And I've had a good discussion with my school board, my administrative team, and we believe that HB 212 would be beneficial to us. It would give us another avenue. It would allow potential for a major maintenance backlog of projects to be taken care of. It would help help our district for sure and many others. For this session, major maintenance grants, as you know, I know you've heard it from others, need funding in the capital budget. Governor Walker asked for $70 million in HB 282, so I'm asking that you would please consider funding, placing that funding in that capital budget for major maintenance and passing HB 212. And I just want to thank Chairman Foster for supporting this bill.
Thank you. And Representative Guttenberg had a question.
Carrie, good to hear your voice. I hope you're enjoying spring at home. Could you describe your school district geographically? I think it would be interesting to for people to hear what the geographic spread of your district is.
Well, sure. We have six urban areas. I'm at one of them right now at our Eagle River office. We have them all over Fairbanks, Wasilla, Delta, Juneau, and then we have 10 rural remote schools based off of spread out over 70,000 square miles that we have to fly into. Two of them you can drive into. I prefer to fly because the roads can be dangerous. But we have some older schools. We've been chipping away through the use of the major maintenance and capital and new construction list.
Thank you.
And thank you. Are there any further questions? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. I don't see anyone else on the room that wanted to test, I mean on the lines. Is there anyone in the room that wishes to testify on House Bill 212? Seeing none, I will close public testimony, and we have the bill before us. Any final questions of the sponsor? What's the committee's desire? Representative Wilson.
So, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move CS for House Bill number 212-30-LS074/U with 1-0 fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Thank you. Motion to move. We didn't. Is the zero fiscal note explanation enough for everyone? No objection to just the notation that it is a zero fiscal note. Seeing no objections, is there an objection? Seeing no objections, House Bill 212 will move from committee. With individual recommendations and zero fiscal note, and we'll take a few minutes to at ease to sign the paper.
Okay. House Finance is back on record at 3:18 p.m. And our next bill up today is HB 231, which is Commercial Fisheries, Entry Commission, Board Salary, Staff Classified Service Oil Spills, Pollution Penalties, and Prevention by Rules by request of the Governor. And here to present the bill is the Department of Administration Deputy Commissioner Sylvan Robb and CFEC Commissioner Fate Putman. So Ms. Robb and Commissioner Putman could come to the table, put yourselves on the record, and go ahead and start with your presentation.
Thank you. I'll go first just so I'll let you start out with the presentation. Just to get used to my voice, Fate Putman from CFEC. I'm the chairman and one of the commissioners serving on that commission.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Sylvan Robb. I'm the deputy commissioner for the Department of Administration. And to begin our presentation today, we thought we would spend just a brief moment and have Commissioner Putman tell you what the CFEC does, just as a reminder.
Well, thank you. Again, Fate Putman through the chair. And we do have a PowerPoint prepared for you so you can follow along. I'll just cover it briefly for you, and if you have any questions, you can ask me clarifying questions. What we do at the CFEC is we license all commercial fishing, whether they're in a limited fishery or an open fishery. There are 68 limited fisheries and about 200 open fisheries, but every commercial fisherman who fishes in any of these fisheries receives a license from CFEC, Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission, and also at the back end, we check to see what kind of X vessel, meaning how much money they made through their fishing, and we charge 0.4% of that X vessel value to help also support the commission. And as we also issue transfers and annual commercial fishing permits and licensed vessels, we issue about 16,000 licenses a year. We issue about 60 transfers of licenses over the course of any year. Those transfers might be either emergency transfer or permanent transfer, depending on the circumstances of the person requesting that. We also have a research department that studies and analyzes fishing economics around the state. We look at stresses on fisheries and determine if those fisheries are in need of some more support or perhaps limitation. We have not limited a fishery since 2004, although of those 200 fisheries we were talking about, at any time in the future, any one of those fisheries could be limited, and so that's what we're watching for. We also collect data about fisheries. That data is shared with a number of different agencies, including NOAA and NMFS and other federal and state agencies to help them determine what's going on in a fishery. Most of the information that we obtain from fishermen is all confidential. Cannot be shared. The actual information cannot be shared, but our reports become essential for other agencies who use that data. We also are concerned about sustainable yield, which is a constitutional provision that makes sure that in our situation with fisheries, that fisheries are sustainable. Unlike other types of resource extraction, fisheries is a sustainable resource because it returns year after year, and of course our mission at the Commission is to optimize the number of biomass for fishermen and to look at how many permits are any particular fishery to see if there's too much stress on that fishery. Another aspect of the Commission that's been asked of us by the legislature about 20 years ago was to assess demerit points to any fisherman who receives too many convictions in any particular fishery. At the time that this was adopted in 1998, they limited just to salmon fisheries, so we look at salmon fisheries for these demerit point systems, but the court has the ability to suspend licenses in all other fisheries, and then they notify us, and then we suspend the license of those fishermen. So that's basically an overview of the commission, and maybe I could turn it back to Deputy Commissioner Robb for an analysis of the legislation.
Ms. Robb?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So House Bill 231 does three primary things. It reduces the number of commissioners for CFEC from 3 to 2. It also changes the compensation for the one commissioner who is not the chair, so the individual commissioner who is the chair would remain at range 27 as they are now, and then the other non-chair commissioner would go down to a range 24. This brings the salary ranges more in line with salaries of similar people in other state agencies, particularly the Office of Administrative Hearings. And then the third thing that this bill does is it moves the staff at the commission from the exempt service to the classified service. When we make this move, we would do a classification study to determine where folks should be in the classification system. This existing staff at CFEC, there are 13 staff there now, would be held harmless in terms of their pay. So if the classification study determined that their pay would be at a lower range than it is now, then they would remain there until the classified range caught up to where they are. So they would not experience a decrease in pay. Anyone new coming into CFEC would come in at the new classification levels, and they would start at Step A. And then as staff, once they joined the classified service, they would become members of the appropriate union, either the supervisors union, GGU, or the confidential employees. And so HB 231 is needed over time. There have been a number of studies, and the workload for the CFEC has decreased, and so having three commissioners, as studies have shown in the past, it's more appropriate workload for two commissioners. And it will save money as we align the commissioner salaries with the similar ranges and similar positions, as I mentioned, the staff at Office of Administrative Hearings. And it aligns staff to their counterparts who have similar work duties in the classified service. And then we do have an organizational chart showing the current organization structure for CFEC. And obviously, as you can see at the top, there shows the three commissioners that are currently there. And so this would decrease that number to two. And that's all we had, Mr. Chair, but we're certainly happy to answer any questions.
Great, thank you. And also available online for questions is Kate Sheehan, Director, Division of Personnel and Labor Relations, Department of Administration. So she is online and available for questions. Are there any questions from the committee? Representative Kara?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think the representatives to the left of me and I were talking about who's not fully within our wheelhouse. So are there decisions the commissioners have to make that with two you would have a tie, or that's not a big issue?
Fate Putman again for the record, and through the chair, Representative Guerra. If I could turn your attention to the legislation at section, let me just pull it up quickly, at section 6. In this case, if this legislation goes through and there are two commissioners making decisions about commission permits and things like that, those decisions are made initially by hearing officers. So we have a bank of hearing officers who take testimony, collect personal information about fishermen, and make a recommendation to the commission about whether a permit should be granted or not, or whether a transfer should be granted or not. And those decisions then come to the commission. And the current commissioner and I, Commissioner Kelly, Dale Kelly, we're planning to work in a consensus basis. But if the fact that we can't reach a consensus, then the decision of the hearing officer becomes the decision of the commission, which is then appealed to the superior and eventually to the Supreme Court. And just to give you an idea of what the caseload that we've dealt with over the years, there have been thousands of cases before the commission. Hundreds of those have been appealed to the Superior Court, which sits in a appellate situation for our hearings. And then finally, they go to the Supreme Court. We've had 70 cases go to the state Supreme Court. So this agency has generated a lot of casework for the courts. We basically are a clearinghouse to make sure that some of those cases get resolved prior to getting into the court system. But, of course, everybody has an opportunity to appeal those decisions if they so desire.
Follow up?
That may be a dumber question. I really don't have any answer to this. I'm just asking. So the is there a reason why we need two commissioners, and is it too much work for one commissioner if you're reviewing cases that get appealed?
That's a very good question. Through the chair, Representative Guerra. I've been at the commission for 4 months now, since December 1st, and I can tell you that there is a tremendous number of activities going on at the commission, particularly in upgrading the commission, modernizing fisheries, and then looking at optimum numbers. And I am very pleased that I have a second commissioner appointed by the governor and up for consideration for confirmation, who has an extensive history in fisheries and has a lot of knowledge in that area. I'm an attorney. You don't have to be an attorney to serve on this commission, but I think the balance between the two of us will make decisions better decisions and more balanced decisions. So I think reducing from three down to two for the near term makes sense. If we get in a situation where we have a closed fishery, we might be back here asking for a third commissioner, because those decisions that we make are very vital for the fishermen and women out there. We make decisions on whether someone gets a permanent transferable permit or a non-transferable permit. Those are very important decisions to people as they move forward in commercial fishing. And I could get into more detail of that if you'd like, but these are very difficult decisions, and it's always best to have at least two minds involved in those cases.
Thanks.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the way I understand it, and I don't know, sorry, a whole lot about this commission, but the way I understood that you said a while ago is that you go to a hearing officer first. If they didn't like that answer, then they would go to the commission. If they don't like the commissions, then they go to court. So how many cases that have come to the commission have been, how many have been overturned from the appeals? First, you know, when I first go, I'm the hearing officer. How many of those has the commission overturned? And then how many has the court overturned from the commission?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, that is a very good question that I don't have an answer for. That I can tell you that I know that many of the cases have been overturned, but many, meaning two or three out of the 70 cases. We had one case that went to the Supreme Court five different times. When the commission makes a decision and it gets appealed to the Superior Court, that court oftentimes remands decisions back to the commission. I've handled two remands since I've been there in the last 4 months, from the Superior Court back to the commission, where in essence that's kind of like an overturned case, and we make a redetermination on our decision, and then it goes back to the Superior Court, and then back, and then on from there to the Supreme Court. So in my experience, yes, it does happen. And of course, those are the choices that, you know, people make, whether they want to appeal the decision of the commission and go on to a further court. And there are lots of attorneys involved in this whole process, as you might guess.
Hello, Mr. Chairman. Hello. So if the commission wasn't there, then would the process be is after the hearing officer heard it, again, they could appeal to the courts, and instead of coming back to the commission, it would just go back to the hearing officer versus a commission? I guess nothing personal, but I'm just trying to figure out why we need the commission, because it almost just seems like another middleman to go through when ultimately they could go to court if they want to.
Well, I think if you look in administrative agencies that have a single commissioner, there is a number of appeals that happen in these individual agencies, not our commission, where those decisions come to a commissioner, for the Commissioner of Labor, for example, or Fish and Game. Decisions are made by them that get appealed to a court. In this particular case, I believe the legislature determined back in the day that because this is such a multi-million dollar industry, at that time they thought three commissioners was necessary to make sure that there is a balance on the commission, and we are trying to follow with that intent with the two commissioners to make those tough decisions.
I follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow up.
But in this legislation on page 2, I lost the section, basically it says though if there are not two commissioners, then basically by default one commissioner can make all the decisions until a second one is put there. So how is that different with one person being there than just the one hearing officer you would have anyway?
Thank you, Representative Wilson, through the chair. You're referring to Section 2, which follows over on the page, or starts on page 1, follows over to page 2. This is designed for the circumstance, and the rare circumstance, where there is a vacancy on the commission. If there's a vacancy on the commission, in order, if in fact that position person wasn't there and something happened to them dramatic, the commission would not exist anymore without a quorum of two. So that's why Section 2 is so important for when we're running with just two commissioners and the quorum is at two, as it is in you'll see in Section 3, then that allows the commission to continue to function. But the intent for at least the way I'm looking at it is that that is only in a condition of a vacancy and not in a condition where that commissioner, if it was left with one commissioner, to make all the decisions of the commission. That, of course, it would be handled down the road at some point by a future governor and a future legislature.
And Mr. Chairman? And that's a little concerning because it's all about whether or not somebody wants to, you know, somebody could just not be appointed, which wouldn't be the commission's fault because they don't have that authority. But I'm just trying to figure out how that goes in there. When we're talking about the range 27 and a range 24, and we have $8,789 a month for range 27 and $7,225 for range 24, I'm assuming that's the low amount. And if somebody's been in state government before in some kind of factor, then you would have steps that would be added. Or is it that if you are appointed to this, that you would start, that this would be your full salary the whole time that you were there?
And I'm going to punt that to the Deputy Commissioner.
Through the Chair, Representative Wilson, that is the beginning of those ranges. And so if people do continue in state service and were to advance to additional steps, their pay would increase over time.
And follow up?
Follow up.
So if I was already in state service, let's say, and then I moved over, would I start at a different range than somebody who had not been in state government at all?
Through the Chair, Representative Wilson, I believe you're asking if somebody is already in state service and they came over, would they retain their current step? So they would be at the range specified, but if they were already in service and were at a higher step than A, they would come in at the step that they already had obtained through their previous service.
Okay. And another question, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you. This is a whole new thing to me. We give our fish back in the interior. We don't get to keep them. So the other question I have, why are we unionizing employees? Is there a problem? I remember I went to I heard the only reason you need unions is because you have bad employers. That's what it was said. And so I'm assuming the state's not a bad employer, but I could be wrong. So why are we looking to unionize employees? Is there a problem?
Through the Chair, Representative Wilson, no, we're looking to move the staff to the classified service because there are similar positions within the classified service, and so it feels most appropriate to have all those people together because then we can apply the state principle of like pay for like work to ensure that everyone who's in the same class is receiving the same compensation.
So if we could just get some kind of chart to understand better, you know, what the pay scale is if you're not unionized to, because they have several different unions listed in the presentation on page 3, the supervisors, general government unit, or the confidential employee association. I think we need to understand what pay we have right now and what that might look like over time, because I know they'll start where they're at, but I don't know whether you'll grow faster if you're in one of these unions versus if you stay, you know, in the type of classification they are now. If we could get that information, that would be very helpful, as well as the numbers on the appeals portion.
I also, thank you, and I also wanted to mention Kate Sheehan, I said was online, but is in the room, actually, in case anybody has questions. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to clarify. When it was said that if you were in state employee and you went over and you change position to a different range, you would keep your same steps. I thought as you went up in range every two, if someone was a range 22 and was appointed to this position at a range 24, don't you start the steps over again?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize if I said that, then I misspoke. You are very correct. If someone was at a lower range position and obtained one of these commissioner positions, when they came in, they would start at step A in the new range.
Hey, do we have any further questions? Seeing none, we'll go over to public testimony. Oh, Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So to summarize, can you just summarize the impact of this bill, what it specifically does? Just kind of brief.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Through the chair, thank you, Representative Ortiz. The three primary things: it reduces the number of commissioners from 3 to 2. It changes the pay range for the commissioner who is not the chair from range 27 to range 24, and it moves the staff of the commission from the exempt service to the classified service.
Representative Ortiz?
And the net impact of that will be to drive down the costs of the CFEC and what goes on with the CFEC. Is that correct?
That is correct, through the chair, Representative Ortiz. But just to reiterate, the staff who are there now will be held harmless in terms of their pay.
Thank you.
Representative Pruitt?
How many staff do you have?
I'll address that, Fate Putman, again, from the CFEC. There's an org chart in here that might be of assistance to you, but I want to clarify that org chart for you. There are 22 positions at the CFC, including three commissioners. One of those commissioners is vacant. If you also notice the next few lines down, there's a legal specialist. That position is vacant, along with the executive secretary, also vacant, and a clerk is vacant. And then the research department is also vacant. So there's actually 15 employees who actually currently work there. There have been four employees that have left the commission since I've started 4 months ago. So the commission has constricted. I think that's the direction that we're headed with this commission, although we also anticipate needing some more research assistance in determining future stresses on fisheries. So we're investigating whether we need to add another position that would fill one of these vacant positions.
Just one follow-up.
Representative Pruitt?
And then just did the employees, did they ask to have their status changed?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, there was some interest from employees in moving to the classified service.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any further questions? Seeing no further questions, we will go over to public testimony. We'll open that on HB 231. And if anybody would like to submit written testimony, they can do so by emailing us at housefinance@akleg.gov. Again, housefinance@akleg.gov. And is there anybody in the room who would like to testify? And I don't see anybody online. There's nobody online, so we will close public testimony on HB 231. And so at this time, we will go ahead and set aside HB 231. We will ask that amendments be due to Jane Pearson in my office by 5 p.m. on Tuesday, April 3rd, 2018. So with that, we will move over to our next bill, which is HB 316, Restrict Access to Marijuana Crime Records, by Representative Drummond. And here to present the bill is Representative Drummond's aide, Mr. Patrick Fitzgerald. And if you could put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Hello, Co-Chairs Seaton and Foster. My name is Patrick Fitzgerald. I am staff to Representative Harriet Drummond. And let's get started on carrying House Bill 316. House Bill 316 is intended to clean up court and permanent records of Alaskans convicted of simple possession of marijuana charges before legalization. The burden of lifelong criminal records or crimes that is now legal for Alaskans has kept Alaskans from achieving their fullest potential. House Bill 316 is not designated to wipe the crime the records of serious offenders or give a clean slate to serious offenders. House Bill 316 will eliminate obstacles that have been keeping Alaskans from gaining employment, advancing in a career, or qualifying for certifications because of a simple possession charge on their record. Mothers, fathers, neighbors, and friends who have made mistakes in their past or were simply in the wrong place at the wrong time have to deal with a tall barrier that has the potential to keep them from higher quality of life. This is not a marijuana bill. This is a jobs bill. Recreational use of marijuana has been legal for 3 years as of this past February 25th. Alaska has received millions in state revenue generated from the cannabis business, and small business owners have started to prosper in the cannabis economy. Many Alaskans have benefited from cannabis legalization and now have the chance to expand the group and eliminate barriers that are holding back Alaskans and stunting their ability to be productive, contributing members of society. Please support House Bill 316. I am now able to go over the sectional if the committee wishes and explain the changes that were made in House Judiciary.
Please proceed.
Current version of the bill. Section 1, Alaska Statute 12.62.160, stating that an agency may not release the records of a criminal case to the public if the defendant was charged with possession of a controlled substance Schedule 6A. And I'll just give a definition of Schedule 6A as defined in Alaska Statute 1171-190. Is a substance shall be placed in Schedule 6A if it is found under or found to have the lowest degree of danger or probable danger to the public. And then Section B is marijuana is Schedule 6A, controlled substance. And then also under Section 1 is the person must be 21 years or older at the time of the offense. Section 2 is amended by adding Alaska Statute 22.35.040, confidential court records. A court record of a criminal case will be made confidential if the defendant was convicted of 6A possession through the state or local ordinance in a stand-alone charge. Section 3, every person has the right to inspect a public record in the state, including public records in records offices, except, and this would be Section 18, records of Schedule 6A possession for less than 1 ounce if it is a standalone charge. Defines that person must have been 21 years or older at the time of conviction to apply. Section 4 alters indirect court rule amendment Alaska Rules of Administration by limiting public access to certain case records. Section 5 states that because of the Section 4 in this act, it must receive two-thirds majority vote in each house because of Article 4, Section 15 of Alaska State Constitution. And Section 6 provides an effective date of 120 days after bill signing.
Got a question from Representative Seaton?
Yes.
Thank you. You mentioned a couple times standalone. How I don't see the words in here, standalone. Get Schedule 6A controlled substance on page 4, you know, line 20, you know, Section 18. Line 19 through 23. Am I missing it?
Patrick Fitzgerald to Representative Seaton. It says at the end there, line 22 through 23, and was not convicted of any other charges in that case.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if I was actually taken in with a higher charge, but for whatever reason they decided, maybe it was a plea bargain, to go with a lower amount, I would then have my records completely sealed. As long as the conviction was on this lower level here.
Patrick Fitzgerald, through the chair, if it's to my understanding that if the courts had plead down to a possession-only charge, that there was a reason for doing so, and that individual who was convicted of the possession charge with a plea down, they should not still be discriminated against for this legislation.
Follow up. So let's say I got a DUI and a marijuana charge, and let's say at that time the marijuana charge had, because maybe it was also a misdemeanor for the DUI, was my first DUI, and so the DA decided to plea bargain the marijuana, my DUI charge would also go away with this law, correct?
Patrick Fitzgerald, through the chair, as Representative Wilson, no, the DUI charge would not go away.
Follow up? I don't think that's what this is saying, because it says, on the ones that you just said on page 4, it says, Records of a conviction under AS 1171060 are a municipal ordinance with similar elements for possession of less than 1 ounce of a scheduled 6A controlled substance if the defendant was 21 years of age or older at the time of commission of the offense and was not convicted of any other charges in that case. So if I had a DUI and a marijuana that was combined, it happens, I don't know if all the time, I won't say all the time, but together, and I was only convicted of the marijuana charge, the way that, in my opinion, that this reads, and we might be able to ask Ms. Mead if he needs a little help with it, that both the charge and the conviction would be sealed away.
Patrick Fitzgerald, through the chair to Representative Wilson, I would be happy to let a member of the courts or DPS or law answer this question, but it's to my understanding that it is very, very rare for a DUI charge to plea down to a possession only if it's less than 1 ounce of marijuana possession.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't really care what's rare. I really care whether or not other, it could be, and I could fill the blank in with anything else, but the way I'm reading this, that there could be five charges, and as long as conviction was just on one, everything else goes away. It wouldn't be on court view. I couldn't go in the courthouse. I couldn't, from my money, I couldn't find it anywhere. So I don't know, do we have law online or maybe Ms. Mead knows, whoever knows the answer.
We do have Alan Birnbaum from the Department of Law. We've got Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System, and Catherine Monfreda, Chief Criminal Records and Identification Bureau. Ms. Mead, I think, are you the best person to answer this, if you could put yourself on the record? And if anybody else would like to chime in on that, feel free to speak up and we'll recognize you.
Thank you. For the record, this is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System, and I'd be happy to try to answer through the chair, Representative Wilson. Section 2, which applies to the court records at least, does work the way that you're saying in your hypothetical. That is, it doesn't matter how many charges are in the case. This covers if they were convicted under that and weren't convicted of any other charges in the case. Now, the question of how often that happens would be outside my expertise, but you're correct, I believe, in your interpretation of the way this reads.
I follow up?
Representative Wilson.
So instead of a DUI, say it was a domestic violence instead, which could come with marijuana, that would even include the domestic violence charges, because there's no exemption for what type of other charges that there were.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, there is no exception. So under, at least for the court records, that would mean that whole case, if it's all charged in one case, that whole case would become confidential and would not be accessible to the public either in its paper form, and then obviously would not be posted on court view either. And again, I make no judgment about how often that might happen with DV and marijuana.
Okay, and I have a different question then.
Representative Wilson?
So I just want to kind of get an idea of the reason for the legislation. I know the sponsor is here, and she may want to come and answer this question. But so is the idea of the legislation that because marijuana is now legal in the state, that we should go back and those people who were convicted would not have been convicted underneath the same – would not have been convicted because the law has changed?
And for the record, I'd like to recognize that we've been joined by Representative Drummond. And Representative Drummond, if you would like to make any comments.
Thank you, Representative Foster, Representative Seaton, and members of House Finance. When the marijuana initiative was brought forward, it was decided by the makers of the initiative not to include this feature. It has been featured in other states. In the meantime, other states that have legalized marijuana, commercial marijuana, have proceeded to do exactly what this bill proposes to do. I believe Vermont has, the governor has actually expunged about 200 people's records in Vermont once marijuana was legal in Vermont. And in California, local district attorneys are beginning to do that themselves. But as you can imagine, the size of the population in California makes that much more complicated than it does here in Alaska.
And a follow-up?
Follow-up.
And so, using that philosophy, you know, that it would no longer be illegal, wouldn't it make just as much sense as we've changed the felony rules and misdemeanors when we were talking about just a year ago that we've raised how much it costs, how much you can steal, for instance? We raised the amount of money that you wouldn't go back into everybody else's records and say, well, it was a felony at that time and now it's a misdemeanor, wouldn't you want to try to be even across the board as laws have changed and people might not have felonies anymore and they would have been misdemeanors instead?
I think we're covering new territory with marijuana legalization. It's always been illegal to steal and commit various other crimes, such as you referred to, Representative Wilson. But since we made marijuana legal in this state several years ago now, and since many people are profiting from it and benefiting from it, I think it's only appropriate to remove that scar from the records of many people who had simple marijuana possession. And again, this is not applying to minors. I have heard of issues that certain people who did possess marijuana when they were minors, and they're now trying to do things like apply to military academies, and they can never remove that from their records, and that is a permanent impediment to their getting on with their lives in the way that they'd like to. But this is for adults with simple possession issues.
And one comment, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
You know, I understand where you're trying to go, but I guess where my concern is, one, is that they could have other charges. And just because they pled to one, then nobody's going to be able to see what those others are. But just because the state profit from this, that when people did it, they broke the law and they knew it was against the law at the time. And now we're kind of saying those particular ones are okay. But as laws have changed for felons and misdemeanors, because we may not be profiting off of those, they're not going to have that same opportunity. I mean, I understand what you're trying to do, but I'm just not too sure that there might be other safety issues within the way it is right now, but we might be able to amend to correct some of that. Thanks.
Thank you. And I believe, Mr. Fitzgerald, did you have more with your presentation? You're going through your document there.
The only additional thing that I have not read was changes that was made in House Judiciary from the original drafting of the bill. And essentially, that just eliminated an effective date, or not the effective date, pardon me, that eliminated the date of convictions prior to February 24th, 2015, which is when the legalization of recreational use of marijuana was enacted. We eliminated that date, and we decided to kind of encompass all charges. And then we specified that the convictees had to be 21 years or older.
Great. Do we have any questions from the committee? Seeing no questions, we will maybe go over to public testimony. Public testimony on HB 316 is now open. And folks may also submit public testimony by emailing us at housefinance@akleg.gov. And we have three people online. Is there anybody in the room who would like to testify? I don't see any, so we will move to the off-nets here. Tara Rich, if you're there, if you could state your name and your affiliation and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, good afternoon. This is Tara Rich. I'm the Legal and Policy Director of the ACLU of Alaska, and I submitted written comments which are available in the committee packet for people to review, but I wanted to provide one perspective that I have not heard yet mentioned in today's committee hearing about who might be among the population of folks for whom these convictions would now be cleared from their public records. And so we did a bit of research on this issue, and one caveat to that research was that we were only able to investigate arrest rates for simple marijuana possession from the relevant years. We were not able to discern demographic data from conviction rates. So this is only for people who have been arrested for simple marijuana possession. And the takeaway there was that in Alaska, from the years, just the 6 years preceding legalization, so from 2008 to 2013, if you were African American in Alaska, you were twice as likely to be arrested for marijuana possession than if you were white. And the same thing goes for what is termed in the APSIN database where this data is tracked as Indian, but it encompasses Alaska Native and Native American folks, that if you were arrested for marijuana possession as an Alaska Native or American Indian, you were 1.5 times more likely during this period to be arrested than if you were white. And so, you know, the main takeaway is that marijuana possession laws have routinely been enforced against people of color. And so HB 316 marks an important step in restoring fairness and equality to a system, primarily a system on the war on drugs, that has disproportionately harmed people of color. And with that, I am happy to answer any questions that the committee members might have.
Thank you, Ms. Rich. Does the committee have any questions? We have a question from Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the person who was convicted, and I don't know whether they were proven guilty or they pled it out, so just because we now made it legal, it was okay at that time that they chose to break the law and should have no more punishment because of that?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the distinction between being convicted and pleading something out, because that is one area in which, I forgot to introduce myself. This is Tara Rich again, Representative Wilson through the chair. Mentioning the distinction between pleading a plea agreement and being proven guilty, especially with these low-level misdemeanor cases, in many areas, it is simply more convenient for people to plead guilty because of the disruption of in their lives of being, separated from their families and incarcerated before the state ever has the chance to even prove that they were guilty of the crime that they're alleged to have committed. And so there's documented and evidence-based data that plea agreements also effectuate the same kind of harm, primarily against people of color and primarily without actually having the state fulfill its burden to prove guilt. I'm not sure if I answered your question or if you want to restate it, but I do think that's an important distinction.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to restate it.
Representative Wilson.
So when someone broke the law, whether they decide to plea it out or they were convicted, they still broke the law. Just because something then becomes legal, should then pretend that it's okay to break the law and just hope that we change the law so that it goes away on your record? Do you think that's okay?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, one aspect of this that's really important to consider is the disproportionate level of policing, particularly against minority communities, so African American, Alaska Native communities. We are documenting that they are having policing encounters with police officers more often than their white counterparts, which results in over-policing of minority communities. And we see this on the national level with surveys done over marijuana use, that marijuana use was at the same rate between African Americans and whites. However, blacks were nearly four times more likely to be arrested for marijuana possession. So I think where we have a system where the people of Alaska have recognized that this is conduct that is not sufficiently important to regulate criminally, and you have a disproportionately unfair system that regulates against people of color and discriminates against people of color, that yes, it's appropriate then to go back and to say to those people that although this is this law has changed, we think it's appropriate now to make sure that people can have a chance to have a clean record and to go forward and get jobs and to get housing and education.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, but I just want to make sure on the record that I don't think our police officers here are targeting anyone in the state. They're just trying to uphold the laws of our state. So I just want to make sure that message is. But thank you very much.
Thank you. Do we have any further questions for Ms. Rich? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. We'll move over to Tim Hinterberger. If you're there, if you could state your name and your affiliation and proceed with your testimony.
Hello, good afternoon. Thank you. My name is Tim Hinterberger. I was chair of the campaign to regulate marijuana that led to the passage of ballot measure 2 in 2014 and the elimination of criminal penalties for possession of limited amounts of marijuana in Alaska. Some people may wonder why a provision to shield the records of persons previously convicted of marijuana possession was not included in ballot measure 2. When we were drafting that language, we wanted to make it as straightforward as possible to maximize the chance of passage, and we knew it would be controversial enough without including anything dealing with past convictions. We also made an effort at the time to follow the language of the Colorado Amendment that had already proven successful in creating a regulated marijuana industry in that state. Now, of course, Colorado and several other states that have legalized and regulated cannabis have adopted measures making it easier for persons with past marijuana convictions to get those records sealed. So, in conclusion, the HB 316 marijuana expungement that has been introduced by Representative Drummond is entirely consistent with the spirit of ballot measure 2, and I support its passage.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Hinterberger. Does the committee have any questions?
I do.
Representative Guerra?
Mr. Hinterberger, thank you for your work in this area. I just want to flag for you. I'm not going to try and add it to this bill, but I just want to flag for you as we go forward. Currently under Alaska law, a student who possesses just simple possession of marijuana on school grounds, that's a Class A felony. And with marijuana being legal, simple possession, not distribution, I just want to put that in your mind for maybe future thought and action. I don't see that happening now, but that's all I wanted to say.
Okay. Any further questions? Seeing no further questions, thank you for your testimony, Mr. Hinterberger. And last up, we have Amy Jackman. If you could state your name and your affiliation, proceed with your testimony.
Hi. Yes, thank you. This is Amy Jackman. I'm calling from the Kenai Peninsula Borough. I was the campaign manager for the Keep Cannabis Legal campaign here last year. We won with an overwhelming 84% of the population voting in favor to keep cannabis legalized. And I do stand to represent most of our cannabis community here. I really want to say thank you to everyone for allowing me this opportunity. It's been very interesting listening to this entire meeting, not just surrounding House Bill 316. And I think that what I have written or prepared for today is it's actually perfect for what I've been hearing. And I would just ask that everyone please listen with an open heart and understand that this comes from a place of wanting, well-being for all of our communities, everyone in the state of Alaska. We divide and chastise. We condemn others as we hold ourselves higher than those around us, not out of love, but of fear. Fear of being judged, fear of losing control, fear of the unknown, when in actuality, most of us aren't really in control. Yes, we may prohibit ourselves from acting irrationally in public. We must keep up appearances. But in private, we all have secrets. Every one of us. Republican, Democrat, Libertarian, Green Party, Socialist, Fascist, there is no shortage of ways to divide. Baptist, Christian, Muslim, Catholic, agnostic, Mormon, no matter how much you earn, $5,000 a year or $5 million a year, all applies equally. If we are focused on our differences, then we are not thinking with or making decisions based on love. There is shame, jealousy, envy, more fear, and hate. We smoke cigarettes, take a pain pill or muscle relaxer. We drink alcohol and become aggressive. Alcohol, which has more statistical data proving it is a cancer than any other one subject, yet we celebrate it like it is holy water. At every turn, it is the norm. We lose control more often than we'd like to admit. We create a world in which no one is good enough. We allow ourselves to succumb to the teachings that we shouldn't judge, but in turn, judge is all we do. We say, you broke this law, therefore you deserve punishment. The problem with cannabis convictions is that the laws were passed based on outright discriminatory lies. Propaganda played from birth to death over the last 81 years. Since the inception of the Marijuana Tax Act of 1937, countless lives have been ruined because of a plant that is proven to kill cancer, mitigate anxiety, treat and cure stomach and intestinal diseases, and to control or cease the deadly abuse cycle of opioids, which are a scourge on our society. Still yet, we build up and praise the doctors in our communities who unabashedly wasted no time in capitalizing off the suffering of others through the quote-unquote trickle-down of the brilliant plan to give corporations rights like human beings. A corporation cannot love. It can foster business practices that show love and act in loving, caring ways, but it cannot love. Our laws that are written by pharmaceutical companies and other corporations like for-profit prisons are not coming from a place of love. They are meant to enslave from the poor to the wealthy, the intelligent and challenged, white, black, and every color in between. Love comes from a beating heart and a biological mind. It comes from the collective energy that flows from deeds and thoughts put forth in love from one of God's creatures. Cannabis is proven to relieve most forms of bodily pain, including muscular and nerve pain, as well as being used to relax and unwind at the end of the day or to stimulate the appetite after chemo. We use cannabis to lift our spirits, to make us laugh, and sometimes to help us cry. We enjoy cannabis by the fire or a moonlit sky, at the beach on a sunny day, kayaking or fishing. Who doesn't love cannabis while gardening in the Alaska sun?
Ms. Jackman?
Sometimes we just need a different perspective. After all, recreation is medicine. Cannabis, in its natural and all naturally derived states, is nothing short of a miracle plant. Any denying this fact, based on thousands of years of use, the mention of cannabis many times throughout the Bible, in which it was used in healing and anointing oils, as well as the many thousands of scientists, doctors, psychologists, and our peers.
I'm sorry, Ms. Jackman, if you're there and if you could hear me, if you could please wrap up.
Okay, I'll be finished very shortly. Thank you. Our peers, who all have scientific and personal proof that cannabis is a healing plant of the mind, body, and spirit, is not doing their homework. Denial of facts that would ultimately help others is not coming from love. The people in our communities that have been condemned based on these lies about this healing plant are our family members. They are our children. They are equal to and no less than you and I. Once a debt has been paid to society, it is our right to be able to feed, clothe, and provide for ourselves. Laws that deny these rights are unjust and only in place to create a system of blame and division and are used for profit off another person's suffering. If you deny these rights to another human, you are not making decisions based on love. Nonviolent criminal convictions based on cannabis should be permanently sealed and never used against any community member, past, present, or future. I ask you to support House Bill 316, and please make this and every decision from this day forward, no matter the subject, is made out of pure love. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jackman. And if you had more, feel free to email that to us at housefinance@akleg.gov. Does the committee have any questions for Ms. Jackman? I don't see any questions, so thank you for calling in. Thank you for your testimony. Is there anybody else in the room or online who would like to testify? I don't see any, so we will go ahead and close public testimony on HB 316. And so with that, we'll set aside Representative Wilson.
Just real quick, do we have public safety on the line?
Let's see here. I do not see public safety on. Oh, wait. Catherine Monfreda, Chief Criminal Records and Identification Bureau, are you there?
Yes, sir, I am.
Okay. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I was just looking at the fiscal note, and I just want to clarify. So would this bill take all these sealed records even from public safety?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the section, that's a little bit of a question that we have as far as the court sealing of the records, if they would still be authorized to give the records to us for our entry into the system so that they're still available for criminal justice and law enforcement purposes.
And a follow-up?
Follow-up?
Because the way I read the fiscal note, and I don't know whether we need clarification from courts or who it is, but it looks like, though, that you're taking the records off of the criminal justice information system. That's what I'm understanding the $100,000 fiscal note to be for. So if you're taking it off there, then I'm assuming that's what public safety utilizes before they, you know, go to someone's house or, you know, approach a car that they pulled over. So you're telling me you're not sure whether or not you'll be taking them off, and that would be up to the what the courts put on court view?
Through the chair, this is Catherine Monfreda, Chief of the Criminal Records and Identification Bureau for the Department of Public Safety. Representative Wilson, no, my understanding is that we would remove these from release for the limited purposes of AS 1262-160B8, which is for employment or licensing purposes. They would still be available for law enforcement and for other non-criminal justice purposes like foster care and those kinds of licenses.
Okay, so if maybe we just can get some kind of thing sent to the chairman just telling us who could see it and who couldn't see it, that would be very helpful. And sorry about that, I was just reading the fiscal note and saw a pretty large one and trying to figure out who exactly we were impacting. And I didn't want to impact our troopers or put them at risk.
Good question. Thank you, Representative Wilson. So if we could, somebody could get us that information. Are there any other questions on HB 316? We're going to go ahead and set that aside. And if folks would like to submit any amendments, I don't know if next Tuesday is a deadline that folks are okay with. We'll try to be flexible, but we'll set a deadline for now of 5 o'clock on Tuesday, April 3rd, 2018. If things come up later, we can revisit that. So are there any questions before we Representative Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know we're still hopefully on a schedule of 90 days, and I know in the past there's always been a deadline on how long we in House Finance hear House bills, since hopefully if we're out here 90 days, you know, it takes time to get through the other body. Are you looking at a deadline for that, or are we just going to be here 121 days?
At this point right now, we're going at a pretty good clip with these bills prior to the operating budget over the last week or week and a half. And I think we're going to get back on track. We've talked about maybe having a few morning sessions to get back on track. We don't have a lot of backlog, to my knowledge, and so our hope, we don't have a deadline in terms of, 90 days or 120 days. We're just going to try and get caught up and not plan on 120 days. But at this point, we just don't know. Representative Wilson?
Because if the other body was really quick, I guess you could get it done in 2 weeks. But I just think it kind of narrows that chances down, and I just want to make sure that as people are following, we don't put them out having a public comment on something that really doesn't have much chance of getting through the system. But I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And again, so just for the Finance Committee, we may be doing a few morning meetings. So Representative Seaton, brief at ease. Okay, so House Finance back on record, 4:17, and our next meeting is scheduled for Monday, April 2nd at 1:30 p.m. And at that meeting, we will hear HB 268, opioid prescription information, HB 221, workforce and education-related statistics program, HB 400, which is fees for fire prevention measures. And if there's nothing else to come before the committee, we will go ahead and be adjourned out at 4:17 p.m. Thank you.